The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet-sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, it's great to have Sam Harris on the podcast. Sam is the author of five New York Times bestsellers, including The End of Faith, Letter to a Christian Nation, The Moral Landscape, Free Will, Lying, and Waking Up. The End of Faith won the 2005 Penn Award for Nonfiction. His writing and public lectures cover a wide range of topics: neuroscience, moral philosophy, religion, meditation practice, human violence, rationality, but generally focus on how a growing understanding of ourselves and the world is changing our sense of how we should live. He also hosts the Making Sense podcast, which was selected by Apple as one of the iTunes best and has won a Webby Award for best podcast in the science and education category. Sam, thanks for making the time to chat with me.
Happy to be here, Scott.
I'm really looking forward to this chat, and I really want to set the tone by saying I appreciate your intellectual honesty and your intellectual bravery. Sometimes one can just be intellectually honest, but it happens to go with the flow of the current of the culture. Mm. But you're intellectually honest, and you don't mind being intellectually honest if it doesn't always win you friends. So I really want to say I appreciate that, even if I don't necessarily agree with everything you say and your arguments. And I thought we could go through very carefully today lots of areas of mutual interest and work through them very carefully and see if we can arrive at some maybe even transcendent conclusions.
So to sure. Speak. Yeah. Happy to do it.
Cool. So since this is the psychology podcast, I did want to start a little bit with your development, your child development. And that's obviously formed some role in who you are today and the kind of interests you have. I'm curious what you're like as a child, and in particular, in the sort of way you interacted with other people and in the way that which you engaged with the truth as a child.
Hmm. Well, insofar as I remember, actually, I just read I guess it was a fourth or fifth grade, review of me by one of my teachers. I just happened to find it. My mother happened to produce this. So it was kind of hilarious to see who I am now prefigured in who I seem to be then. But I was certainly recognizable to myself as a little kid. I think I was very logical and rational and, you know, argumentative, and I was, you know, I was a little debater and negotiator. And I was very interested in many different things. So I was a good student, but I wasn't especially happy. I don't think I was a perfectionist and very hard on myself, I would say. I think I was very self-critical. My dad left when, I was 2.5. So I don't know, insofar as the pop psychodynamics of that are easily interpreted. I mean, I think I kind of internalized that and, you know, that was that framed my childhood pretty decisively. You know, I had a great mom, and I have a great mom, and you know, it was definitely not an unhappy childhood, but the thing that really changed my life. I mean, I'm sure we'll get to this, but you know, when my introspective contemplative life started around the age of 18, that was a very clear break with who I used to be in terms of access to anything like tranquility or, you know, any kind of ease of being in the world. So I don't remember, you know, I'm sure I had my moments as a kid that were just, you know, childlike awe and wonder and joy. I did have those moments, and I had a lot of fun with my friends, but I was in terms of the way myself seemed structured, it was always poised to be unhappy, as any self really is. But I felt like there was like a layer of perfectionism and self-criticism that was, you know, unusually strong, I would say.
Were you in the debate club high school?
No, I don't think there was. If we had a debate club, I didn't notice it. But no, but I still would debate, as you know.
You know, I think one can make the error in looking at your calm demeanor, your tranquility, and kind of assume that, well, there's not much emotion going on. I think one can mm-hmm. easily make that error, as they do with a lot of people who go through many years of meditative practice. I was struck by something you said in an interview when you were describing leaving your father was in the hospital. He was dying. You were 17 years old, and you left the hospital. You didn't really feel full emotion in that moment, but you went then watched a movie. Is that right? Mm. And all these emotions kind of poured out of you when you were able to kind of more fully process what was going on through the medium of art. You remember making that point in an interview?
Yeah, I definitely remember the experience. I mean, so the movie was right on point. It was Terms of Endearment, you know, which has somebody dying of cancer in it, if memory serves. So, which my dad was dying of cancer. So, So I do remember that, where it suddenly gave me access to the kind of the full grief, rather than leaving me like the Sartrean character, or the, I guess it's Camus in the Stranger. Doesn't he get convicted of not crying at his mother's funeral?
Yes, yeah. Yes. Yeah, well, Larry David gets convicted of many crimes like that, of social taboo, and Curb Your Enthusiasm.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, I bring this up because to me that was poignant when you told that story about your father. And I just wanted to bring out a little bit more of the humanity of Sam Harris, I guess was my point in doing that. I know you don't talk about personal things too often, and I certainly don't want to do it in a way that would make you uncomfortable. But I think it's important to paint a picture of you as human as well. Right?
Right. Before I go into full Vulcan mode.
Yes. Yes. Before we talk about Trump.
That paints me as also human. I think my so-called Trump derangement syndrome has revealed me to be all too fraught with emotion. So.
Right. As someone, your critics would say, uncontrolled emotion.
Yeah.
I guess.
Yeah.
Not just emotion, period. Okay.
Needless to say, I disagree on that point, but that's a debate for another time.
Now, you were really interested in martial arts early, even in your youth, right? Not jujitsu, but a ninjutsu. Is that right?
Yeah. Around 14, I got into martial arts, or what seemed to be martial arts at the time. I mean, my sense of what is a truly effective martial art has evolved since then. But yeah, I think I was 14 when I started training, and did that for until I was through college, and then stopped for almost 20 plus years, and then had a midlife crisis and got into Brazilian jiu-jitsu, and then got a lot of injuries, but that was fun.
Well, let's talk about your college days before we get to the midlife crisis.
Okay.
20-year-old crisis. You were in Stanford. You were experimenting with ecstasy-related kind of drugs. Is that right?
Yeah, well, I had one MDMA trip that was really decisive for me. And that was my think it was my sophomore year. Yeah, it was my sophomore year at Stanford.
And did that play a role in you deciding to, like, you dropped out, quite literally, dropped out of Stanford and go on this spiritual journey? Went on for 10 years.
Yeah, sort of. So kind of on paper, it looks like a bad idea. You take drugs and you drop out of college. That is what happened. And yeah, there was almost certainly a direct connection there. I mean, I think what I experienced in that first trip was just that the mind was a very different place than I gave it credit for. You know, that it was possible to experience well-being directly, that in a way that's not contingent upon the success in one's life or, you know, anything one thinks one wanted, right? You know, so I had a girlfriend break up with me the year before, or I guess, you know, just a few months before, and had been pitched into kind of real unhappiness. I mean, I would say, you know, full-on depression as a result of that. So it's like my happiness had seemed to be totally dependent upon being in a relationship that I you know, valued, and being with someone I loved, and just my sense of myself completely imploded. And then I had this experience on MDMA, which was a perfect counterpoint to all of that, right? I just realized, okay, that there's a door in the mind that can swing open, that can leave you with the utter certainty of your capacity for your own, you know, freedom, really, really deep psychological freedom that doesn't need a reference point in your life, right? You could be on your deathbed. You could be, you could tap into this way of being before anything changes in your life, right? So like it was that discontinuity between the way I was feeling, you know, and obviously the mind's capacity to feel that way, and anything one might, link it to in one's life. Now, that I should say, that's also part of what's dysfunctional about drugs. Obviously, I mean, we want our sense of well-being to have some connection to the reality of our lives and the reality of the world, because then you're, you know, the alternative is you can be delusional and you know, you could just be a heroin addict who's lying on the couch and blissing out based on the pharmacology of the moment, but you have a totally dysfunctional life. So I'm not recommending that, but it was the recognition that how I was tending to be by virtue of what I was thinking about and what I was paying attention to had really become a machine producing my unhappiness, right? And the machine stopped during this, you know, 6-hour period on MDMA. And I could feel, as I came down, as I could feel it start up again, I felt, you know, intuitively that I could understand something about the mechanics of this, and that there were other ways to arrest the hideous progress of this machine in my life. And so that's how I got into meditation and other esoteric things, you know, we could talk about.
Well, in terms of esoteric things, is it true that you once worked in the security detail for the Dalai Lama?
Well, not worked. I was really into meditation at that point, and that Dalai Lama was doing a month-long tour of France, you know, teaching in, you know, almost in a different city each night. I mean, he was practically not more than 24 hours in any one place. So it was just literally a tour of France. And my friends, who were also, you know, longtime Buddhist practitioners, many of whom had done 3-year retreats in various meditation centers in France, were organizing this trip. And so I got tapped as you know, yet another student of meditation who could be part of, you know, of the logistics. And so we got, you know, I got put with you know, maybe a dozen other people as part of his security detail, which, you know, didn't strike me as totally inappropriate given I had at this point a pretty long background in martial arts, but, you know, no one else did, right? So it really, we weren't really a security detail. And we were the buffer between him, between his real security detail and the public, right? So like there were, he had like four Secret Service guys with guns who were his real bodyguards.
Right. And you weren't the Dalai Lama's bodyguard.
No, but ironically, we were the ones who had all the conflict with the press and the public because we were the buffer between the real guys with guns and the rabble who were could be surprisingly raucous and weird around the Dalai Lama. It was amazing. I mean, there was actually one moment where somebody literally grabbed him by the robes and turned him around so as to get a picture with him. Right. So it was like if you spend any time at all in a circumstance like that, you do discover some very odd behavior from people. But it was a very interesting way to be with him because I got to spend a month with him, pretty up close and just to see how he functioned in that mode. And he's a very self-actualized guy. I mean, he's just a real mensch. It's an inspiring guy.
I love spending time with people like that. I remember I was on a, this is going to sound funny, but I was on a party bus with Mathieu Ricard.
Mathieu was there too. Yeah, I know Mathieu.
Oh,
yeah.
Wonderful, wonderful. We were at a conference together and I can genuinely say that he seemed so content with his being. You know,
yeah.
there's something about a certain contentness with being where, you know, people were making, you know, tawdry jokes. You know, people were making inappropriate jokes about the party bus we were on and he laughed. You know, there's something about an ease of consciousness where someone can sort of just get amusement from all aspects of human nature.
Yeah, I mean, Mathieu is a remarkable person. I mean, as you probably know, he was a scientist before he became a monk. So he's got a PhD in molecular biology, and then has studied with some of the greatest Dzogchen teachers of the 20th century. Mathieu is he doesn't take himself seriously. So he's a wonderful guy.
So this 10-year period of your life was a very formative period for you. You studied with some very big name leaders in the Buddhist tradition of meditation.
Facilitated by Mathieu. Mathieu was translating, every teaching I got from his teacher, Dugo Kensi Rinpoche, Mathieu was translating for, and so I spent some time with him and his teachers in Nepal.
What a wonderful serendipity there. I had when I brought up Mathieu's name about being on a party bus, I had no idea you had spent so much time with Mathieu, and he was so formative in those years of your life. So I'm really glad. I'm glad I brought it up then.
Yeah.
Glad I brought that up. I was really amazed when I looked into this and preparing for this interview and I saw who you studied with. I didn't even know all these people that you, I knew the people, but I didn't know you had studied with them. So my eyes widened, you got such a firsthand look at not only, the character structure of some of these leaders as well as their teachings. Right. So I'll just mention some names. Sayadaw Pandita.
Upandita, yeah.
Upandita. Yeah. It's not like university. Yeah. Ooh.
Yeah.
So can you tell me a little bit about that experience? Because I think that you had mixed feelings about it, if I understand correctly.
Yeah. So broadly, I when I started practicing meditation, I got into Vipassana first. And Vipassana is this, usually translated as insight meditation. And it comes from the oldest school of Buddhism, the Theravada. That's the Buddhism of Southeast Asia, Thailand and Burma, Sri Lanka. And it is the tradition that has given us this boom in mindfulness. Mindfulness is an export from the, the Theravada Vipassana teachings. It's not to say that it doesn't have analogs in other traditions of Buddhism and even in other traditions, but it's, mindfulness framed as mindfulness is really, Theravada Buddhism. So I started with that and spent a fair amount of time on retreat studying with, both Western students of the practice, like, Joseph Goldstein, who's who was certainly my main Western teacher, but, you know, Jack Kornfield and Sharon Salzberg and all the people who started, you know, IMS and Spirit Rock. I did most of my retreats at IMS, at, you know, the Insight Meditation Society in Massachusetts. And they brought Saito Upandita out to teach there. And he was, you know, he was their teacher of again, Theravada, Vipassana, you know, Insight Meditation. And he was a very rigorous kind of martial style teacher. He was a monk, and when you sat with him, you took, you know, some subset of the monk's vows. So you, you know, you didn't eat after noon, and you tried to only sleep 4 hours a night, and it was just wall to wall meditation. And so I spent several months on retreat with him. I did, you know, at least. I did a 2 month retreat and I think one or two 1 month retreats with him. I sat with him in Australia for 2 months at one point. And yeah, that was, it was extremely useful, but it, the logic of that practice was something that I felt that I eventually graduated from it and moved on to a different way of thinking about just, you know, why one is paying attention to one's experience in this way and what there is to realize about the nature of the mind. You get the division conceptually is really between dualistic and non-dualistic forms of mindfulness. I mean, that's the way I tend to talk about it when I talk about these things in Waking Up, my meditation app, or in the book by that name. And so then I moved on to study with some of these other teachers we'll talk about, but you know, like Matthew's teachers in Nepal, they were teaching a style of meditation called Dzogchen, which is a non-dual kind of awareness practice, which is, you know, in some ways the same. I mean, it's not that there's something different to realize ultimately, but it's a different set of instructions with respect to just, you know, what to pay attention to and why. And I think there's a lot that goes by the way of meditation instruction that is ultimately somewhat misleading. And you know, if you get deeply into it, if your life is about seeking enlightenment at any point, if you really want to fundamentally change the firmware of your mind, you know, it's possible to really get frustrated and to experience a lot of psychological pain born of one's, you know, spiritual seeking. And so that's, Dzogchen is a Tibetan teaching, which is often translated as great perfection. It can also be translated as great completion. So the message is there's a completeness and perfection to the nature of consciousness itself inherently, right? That there's something that to realize about consciousness that you're not producing by your efforts, right? It's not that you're meditating so hard that you wind up perfecting consciousness. No, it's you're recognizing something that's already there, right? This is not a something you're manufacturing. And it's an important distinction because it's, you can, at a certain point, you can get the sense that, you know, all the work you're doing contemplatively, I mean, you know, sitting for a dozen hours a day, day after day, week after week, month after month, in many cases, year after year. If you ask yourself why you're doing that, right, there can be an implicit logic to it that is both false and unhappiness producing, which is that you can feel that, you know, you really are bound, right? You're really not free in this moment, and you have to do something rather heroic to get free. I mean, there's a prison you have to escape from, right? You have to, or there's a disorder in your mind that you have to put right. And even if you understand that that's not quite the right way to think about it, there's this tacit sense in each moment that you're not good enough. Your life isn't good enough. Your experience isn't good enough. And that's why you are making these weird efforts in the first place, right? I mean, you want to improve something about your mind, right? You're neurotic and you don't want to be neurotic, right? You're having anxiety attacks and you don't want anxiety attacks, right? You notice that your relationships are mediocre because you're not all that loving and you can't figure out how to get more loving, right? You know, so it's like you've got a problem you're trying to solve. There's a knot you're trying to untie. And so even if you're given a philosophy which says, no, actually the mind is intrinsically radiant and pure and you just have to recognize that, you're trying to do that because you have a problem that you want to solve, right? You don't recognize that really. And now you're trying to because you want to put out these various fires in your life. So it's a bit of a conundrum how you can ever get to the place where you're not making those kinds of dualistic, you know, problematized efforts, and you're actually enjoying what the mind is like before you screw it up by, you know, seeking happiness. Anyway, Dzogchen unties those knots very directly, and it was very useful to get the time I got with those teachers. I mean, my main teacher was Tukurgan Rinpoche and also Nyosho Kan Rinpoche, and those are both people who Tukurgan I only saw in Nepal, you know, where Matthew and was, but he wasn't the primary student of Tukurgan Rinpoche. I was dealing with different translators at that point. So,
didn't you study with Dilgo Khyentse as well?
Yeah. So yeah, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche was Matthew's main teacher and really one Rinpoche. The great lamas of his time.
Did he appear in a dream of yours before you met him? Am I making that up?
Yeah, I forgot where I spoke about that, but
I wasn't even sure if that was you, but that was you. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's funny. Now I remember I actually told the Dalai Lama, who Dalai Lama also studied with Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. He was his Dzogchen teacher. And I told the Dalai Lama about this dream, but in the middle of my telling him this story, I realized that there was no way to tell the story without pointing directly at his face, because that's what Dilgo Khyentse was doing to me in the dream. He was pointing in my face. And the dream doesn't make any sense. I mean, I can tell you what the dream was. It makes absolutely no sense without pointing. But it's in fact a cultural taboo to point at someone, you know, in Tibet, right? Like it's essentially, you know, as far as I understand it, akin to, you know, giving someone the finger. I mean, it's just rude. And here I'm now, and I've launched very enthusiastically into telling a dream to the Dalai Lama, who I'm sitting directly across from, you know, like it's just me and him. And it's just, you know, I've launched into this thing and now I realize I'm about to point in his face. So I kind of half pointed, and I'm not even sure that it was a coherent story at that point. No, the dream was actually quite simple and brilliant. It was one of those dreams where you realize that there seems to be a part of your mind that understands something that you, the dream protagonist, doesn't, right? So like I was in dialogue with, you know, obviously some imaginary person in my dream, you know, a product of my own mind. But he was saying and doing things that were totally coherent and enlightening, actually. And the dream protagonist was fairly stupefied by being in this relationship. And the dream protagonist was me, right? So it was just one of those moments where clearly the mind is bigger than you thought you were in that moment, you know. So it's this kind of a partitioning of intelligence. But anyway, the dream was he was looking directly into my eyes, and he was saying, "Tell me." Tell me who you are. And I was kind of struggling for words, and he said, "Tell me," and he pointed directly into my face, and I just kind of, you know, still struggling for words. And he said, "Tell me." And then on the third, "Tell me," he said, tell me, and he pointed directly over my shoulder, right? Looking past me as though there was someone directly behind me, but I knew there was no one behind me. Right. And in that, like And I mean, it actually seemed like I've never heard anyone, you know, I've never heard about any Dzogchen master or any other Buddhist master or any master kind of give this sort of intervention. But there was something about suddenly having like this the intensity of being, you know, being pointed directly to, you know, in my face, and then to have it overshoot me, you know, to kind of go over one of my shoulders. He had actually just sort of teased out the structure of selfhood in my mind, because I realized that there is something about this self, this sense of being in relationship to oneself, that there's an I and a me, you know, the structure of our thought is predicated on this, the idea that you can talk to yourself, right? Yeah. Like if you're the one talking and the one hearing, how does that make any sense? Right. You already know the thing you're saying to yourself, presumably because you're saying it. Right. So it's like when I sit down at this desk and I say, where's that pencil? Right. Like who am I asking? Like, is there someone else in me who needs to be part of the search party? Right. Like it makes absolutely no sense. And it still strikes me to this day as a kind of brilliant gestural way of revealing that this is a false situation, right? That the starting point for your paying attention to these things is not what it seems to be. Anyway, so that's what the dream was quite quite powerful, and that and then I went to Nepal and got to study with him, which was great.
That is brilliant. I'm laughing at one thing you said saying the dream was quite brilliant. I'm thinking like, you know, we'll get to the whole free will thing later, but like, who should take credit for the brilliance of that dream?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah,
because it's funny. Yeah. Well, it's funny because some people are inclined to take, if you consciously wrote that story, it would seem immodest for you to say, you know, my story is brilliant. But for some reason, you saying my dream was brilliant, it doesn't trigger that immodesty. People get what that means. And I think that's interesting. I just wanted to double click on that.
Right. Then there's the question, are we ever more responsible for our thoughts than we are in dreams?
Right. How would we come to the answer to that question using scientific methods? I don't think there is any scientific method that'll adjudicate that answer. But
we'll get into that. Yeah,
we'll definitely get into it. And just to close this childhood so we can get to the real meat of the intellectual arguments. You were a fiction writer and maybe even an aspiring. I heard somewhere that you have in a drawer somewhere a couple novels that you wrote during that 10-year period. Is that true?
I assume they're on one of my hard drives. I don't think I don't know if I have a hard copy of anything at this point. But when I originally dropped out of school, it was kind of I had a dual purpose. I was going to write fiction. I was going to write a novel. And that's, you know, there seemed to be no reason to stay in school if that was my professional aspiration. I mean, no one cares where you went to school or whether you finished if you write the great American novel. So I started doing that, and I also got more deeply into studying meditation and, you know, went to India to study with some people and spent some time on retreat. And then I would come get off and write more fiction. But once I got sufficiently interested in the nature of the mind, I just started writing. I got bent toward writing nonfiction, and then I obviously needed to go back to school to get the bona fides to do that credibly. So that's what changed for me. But the fiction I wrote, I never finished something that I felt like, okay, this is, I can really get behind this. I was growing so much as a writer that, you know, I was kind of sort of I was kind of running across the bridge and it was crumbling behind me. Like every time I finished something, I looked back on it and noticed how inadequate it was as, you know, it was not something that I was going to want to publish.
So you probably won't pull a David Eagle.
I do not think I'm going to publish any of these early novels. No. Yeah.
I say David Eagle because he's published fiction about consciousness and stuff, as well as nonfiction.
Yeah. I could imagine writing fiction again, or writing a play, or writing. I mean, I could imagine wanting to do that. And it's, you know, finding the time, as you know, is always the is the puzzle that needs to be solved here. But I do, Yeah, I could imagine doing that, but I can't quite imagine going back and dusting off the stuff I wrote in my 20s. That's probably not going to happen.
I want to read a sentence that you wrote because I have all sorts of issues with it, and I want to just give you my perspective and see what you think. You say, consider what it would actually take to have free will. You would need to be aware of all the factors that determine your thoughts and actions, and you would need to be in complete control of these factors. To me, the sentence kind of reads like you're an implicit dualist in a sense, because who is the you in that sentence? You know, it's obviously not something non-physical, because in your own view, that wouldn't make sense. So the only remaining possibility is that it's your consciousness. And if it's your consciousness, then how is it even enough to generate ultimate free will, since consciousness must itself be a physical process? So even if it was fully aware of all the influential factors, and even if it were in complete control of them, it would itself still haven't to be a set of physical processes with their own deterministic antecedent causes. Hmm. Also, you know, it seems to me like the role of consciousness is actually pretty large, just indirect. You know, consciousness affects our later choices and actions rather than our immediate ones. So you're absolutely right. You're right when you say that. But I still think it does affect the things that it's still essential to what people mean by the term free will. And that might get to the crux of this argument. You know, people care about the potential for growth and the capacity to exhibit self-control of destructive impulses that might detract them from reaching their long-term goals. That's what people really care about when they talk about free will. So I just wanted to get some of your thoughts on this, because I'm not completely clear I understand that sentence.
Yeah, well, it's not really understandable in that way. I mean, what you've really just landed on is the problem with the concept of free will. It's an incoherent idea. Insofar as we actually connect with what people really think they have, the concept makes no sense. I mean, there are versions of this. I mean, as you know, Dan Dennett has tried to purify the concept of free will in ways so as to give us in his terms, a free will that's worth wanting, right? Like, there's a compatibilist project that tries to say, well, obviously what's called libertarian free will doesn't exist. That makes no sense.
We can all agree on that.
Here are all these other things we have and are right to want, and let's just call those free will. There are several problems with that. One is that it is actually a way of just changing the subject. It's just you're not actually interacting with this spurious and spooky and incoherent thing that people feel they have. And you're not acknowledging just how many important things shift ethically once you let go of that spooky free will. I think that things really do change, and they change in ways that are important, not just for our justice system and our very concept of justice. They're important for our ethical intuitions about just what it means to be a good person and how we should feel in the presence of all of the misadventures we have in life, of just colliding with people who bother us, annoy us, frighten us. How should we feel about evil people? Like, what is this whole demarcation of our world into these concepts of good and evil? How should we think about all that? All of these things shift to a greater or lesser degree once you get rid of this notion of free will. And Dan Dennett's project acknowledges none of that, right? And that's the problem I have. I mean, that's why he and I have never agreed on this topic. The analogy I use is, that we're living in a world where most people believe in Atlantis, right? They believe all the spooky things people tend to believe about Atlantis. They believe in an underwater kingdom and prior civilization that had all the answers and then got submerged, and that's what really preoccupies them. And Dan comes along saying, no, do you realize Atlantis is actually Sicily? And here are all the reasons why Sicily and Atlantis just historically, and you go into what Plato was writing, and it's pretty clear he might have been talking about an island in the Mediterranean, and here's the argument. And okay, so now let's talk about Sicily, right? Okay, we can talk about Sicily, but Sicily is not Atlantis, right? Sicily is not what people think that was. It's not what has infatuated generations of people who've been talking about Atlantis. And people are infatuated by this idea that, again, this is just libertarian free will, that they could have done otherwise, right? Like it seems to most people that if you rewound the movie of their life to a few seconds ago, they could have thought or acted or wanted or intended and therefore behaved differently than they did. And when you do something that angers me, if you say something that offends me, or you do something that, you know, you break a promise, or you do something, my anger also tends to presuppose that ability in you to have a moment ago to have done otherwise. Like you should have done otherwise, right? I'm pissed now because you shouldn't have done that, right? And when you actually trace my emotional reactivity there down to its roots, I am relating to you differently than I would be relating to a gust of wind or a wild animal or a miscalibrated robot or something else that was also behaving the laws of nature about which I would never say it should have done otherwise, right? Like when a machine is malfunctioning, it may cause tremendous harm in my life, right? Or if a wild animal, you know, shows up and starts, you know, if a cougar shows up in my yard and starts attacking me or my kids, that's a horrifying problem to figure out how to solve, right? And it certainly would warrant killing the thing if I can do it, right? But at no point am I under the illusion that this is living out the consequences of its free will and that I'm in relationship to the kind of thing that could and should do otherwise if I could rewind the universe to a moment ago. The rules ethically and psychologically seem to change entirely for people when you're talking about people. You know, they don't think this way about chimpanzees. They don't think about this way about people with certain kinds of brain damage. So there's a certain layer of human ability, right? Behavioral regulation, linguistic production, you know, goal setting. Like there's that layer of our humanness, which arguably is the most important, some of the most important stuff we do, that convinces us that we are not part of the clockwork of the universe anymore, right? And then there are other spooky ideas that get inserted here where people wonder about their souls. You know, they might have an immortal soul that's somehow pulling the strings of the brain, or maybe there's some quantum events here that give us some degree of freedom that, you know, mere monkeys don't have, right? And all from a scientific point of view, there's no reason to grant any of that credence. But the crucial piece here, and this is really my only original contribution to this conversation, because this is for 2,000 years, it's been obvious that free will didn't make any sense. Yeah, it's the problem is it doesn't make any sense. There is no way to describe causality where this notion of I could have done otherwise makes sense. Because randomness doesn't get you there. But the only thing that's original that I've contributed to this, or at least it's original in the sense that I didn't get it from anyone else. I mean, I'm sure someone else has made this precise point because it's there to be made, is that the starting point for this conversation is deeply mistaken. The starting point for everyone is, listen, we know we have free will because we experience it. We have this experience of free will, the experience of I can choose to move my right hand and my left hand, and clearly I'm doing it. No one's forcing me to do it. I can take a long time and decide, and I can go back and forth. Like this is, I am the author of my behavior here. I know this from the first person side, but it's very difficult to figure out how to make sense of this in terms of the streams of causality that I'm not aware of in terms of, you know, gene transcription and you know, neurotransmitter behavior and, you know, all of the causes reaching back to the Big Bang that I didn't author that are, you know, the state of the universe that accounts for me, for what I'm doing, you know, whether it's deterministic or random, all of that causality it's hard to map free will onto all of that, but I know I have it from the experiential side, right? The truth is that is an illusion, right? It's not even an illusion. I mean, my point is that the illusion of free will isn't even there if you look closely at it. So there is no mystery to solve experientially, right? Everything about your experience is totally compatible with determinism or determinism plus randomness, neither of which gives you this freedom people think they have. But honestly, your behavior right now, your emotion, your intention, your thought is totally compatible with the most deterministic picture possible. Like the novel of your life is already written. Say, let's say we live in a block universe where the future exists just as much as the past, right? Where there's literally 0 degrees of freedom. There's no such thing as possibility. There's only what is actual, mm-hmm. right? So the next thing you think and do, you know, your reaction to the thing I'm saying now is already written, right? Let's say that's true. I'm not saying that's the universe we live in, but I am saying that your experience of yourself in the world in this moment is totally compatible with that sort of universe. So there really is no problem to solve here. Now, there are many things that follow and don't follow from that, but we simply do not have an experience of free will. We have an experience of there being a difference between voluntary and involuntary action. And we can talk about the things we do experience, but free will is just not something it's impossible to find a place in your subjectivity to make sense of the claim. It makes no more sense subjectively than it does objectively or in terms of third person causes and effects.
You're really hung up on the magical free will part of this.
It's not hung up. It is what people mean. It is when you have someone who feels that someone should be punished for really punished because they deserve their punishment, the just deserts, right?
Right.
That is someone who feels that the logic of retribution is anchored to libertarian free will. Not that their genes and their environment 100% conspired to make them do what they did.
It seems like the argument you're making is besides the point, though, because I think compatibilist free will, when you really look at the philosophy of mind literature on compatibilist free will, I think it's a lot more like full conceptions of free will than Sicily is like Atlantis in your analogy. Because, you know, the point is that let me outline what I think what you're saying is besides the point, and you tell me why I'm wrong. I'd love to hear why I'm wrong, if I'm wrong. It seems like people can do all the things they care about. If they think that they care about making choices that are somehow uncaused, they just aren't understanding what that literally means, as you point out. What people really mean when they insist that free will is important is they don't want to feel coerced. They think of causes as sources of coercion. But that's a confusion. I think people want to make choices that are consistent with their own goals and be able to deliberate about the causes where their desires aren't totally clear. And they can do those things. And it's pretty clear their consciousness participates causally in that process.
Well, I would dispute that. I think that's uncertain. But
I mean, Roy Baumeister did a global review of the literature and all this. You know, you focus on the Libet, how you pronounce it, LIBET studies.
Yeah.
But that doesn't really get at the issue, because when you actually look at the role of consciousness as playing a causal role in human behavior, you see it's a very pervasive, strong effect of consciousness. I guess the way I view the situation is that we have certain degrees of freedom in depending on the role of the mix of conscious and unconscious processes that we can bring to bear to a task at our conscious at any moment of time. And you don't see there being a wiggle room there in the degrees of freedom of a meaningful sense of the term of free will, of what people care about.
Well, my criticism of free will is happening on another level, and bringing in consciousness is additionally a difficult thing to talk about, right? So I'm familiar with Baumeister's work on consciousness and agency, but it doesn't get at the issue that I'm raising here. So, I mean, for instance, there are certain things I'm conscious of. Right. And I'm conscious and they seem to have a relationship to my behavior. Right. So I'm conscious of you know, just deciding to do this podcast with you, right? So like, it seemed like consciousness was necessary to get us both here to do this podcast, right? But
I hope we don't regret it.
No, not at all. Yeah. So to decide to do something in the future, to organize your behavior such that you actually arrive at the appointed hour.
That's what people care about, right?
Right. Well, so this is voluntary behavior, and it is it's in conformity with various goals and promises, and it's hard to get chickens to behave anything like this, and there's really no other animal that we know of that does a good job of organizing their behavior in this way, and we seem to do it based on consciously thinking about certain things and paying attention to certain things. And there's something that to say that it's conscious is to say that there's a qualitative character to all of that, and there's something that it's like to be me deciding to do a podcast with you, and then showing up and being here and making small mouth noises of the sort that I'm now making. And yes, this is all illuminated by consciousness in our case. Now the question is, one, what is really going on there? And I mean, first of all, everything that that either of us is conscious of is being promoted into consciousness on the basis of neural activity of which we're not conscious, right? So there's a kind of base layer of neurophysiological causality that we can't inspect, and that is simply producing every, like, I'm getting to, how am I getting to the end of this sentence, right? It's in conformity with the grammar of English somehow. Sometimes, right? I make errors. Sometimes I notice them. I mispronounce certain words. But basically I'm, somehow I'm getting to the end of this sentence in something like grammatically correct form. And I can't inspect the micro events I'm not conscious of any of the micro events that are allowing me to do that, right? So there's all the unconscious processing that our conscious phenomenology sits on top of. Now the question is, and this is, essentially a criticism of what Baumeister was up to there. There's much of what we seem to do consciously, it remains mysterious why consciousness need be associated with any of these things, right? Like, we could imagine building robots that could pass the Turing test, that could do all of these things without there being something that it's like to be those robots, right? And so it would be, and maybe that's not in fact possible. Maybe a certain level of intelligent behavior just produces consciousness. The jury's still out on that.
I like the idea that free will evolved in humans. You don't like that argument at all?
Well, no. If we build a robot that can do a podcast, that can agree to do a podcast, that will show up at the appointed hour, that will put it in its calendar, and that will have a Turing test passing conversation with you, at what point in our building, at what point in the manufacture of that robot and in your interaction with it, however pleasant, will you imagine that we inserted free will into its code?
From my perspective, it's just when we've been able to give it conscious control in some way to be able to override its programming, so to speak. Humans evolved an amazing capacity.
It can't override its programming.
Of course we are just our biology. What else would we be? But isn't the point that our biology encompasses all the interesting stuff that we are? I mean, you could still say the robot, it means something for the robot to be a unique robot, right? I mean, don't you think that the interesting thing is that, the biology encompasses, all the unique aspects of what Sam Harris is and who Sam Harris is, including your unconscious and your consciousness?
But the things of which I'm unconscious, right? So here's the, I'm just trying to think of how to get at this so as to have the point land.
Cool.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in on the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com. That's thepsychologypodcast.com. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.
The Black Effect presents Family Therapy, and I'm your host, Elliot Connie. Jay is the woman in this dynamic who is currently co-parenting two young boys with her former partner, David.
David, he is a leader. He just don't want to leave me.
But how do you lead a woman? How do you lead in a relationship? Like, what's the blueprint?
David, you just asked the most important question. Listen to Family Therapy on the Black Effect Podcast Network, iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Elevation with Stephen Furtick podcast was created with you in mind. This is a podcast for those feeling discouraged or needing guidance from God. Together in this podcast, we'll dive deep into scripture, uncover the powerful truths that will help you rise above your limitations and embrace your full potential. We're here to equip you with the tools you need to conquer life's challenges. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.